Hello, dear listeners. This is Elaine Charles with your weekly chapter of The Book Report. I'm so glad you joined me today because we're going to explore what has become a very hot genre, musical biographies. Or should that be biographies of musicians? Either way, this is a fascinating area, especially as the stars baby boomers like me grew up with are starting to turn out stories they may have been too embarrassed, or let's face it, let's be truthful, too stoned to publish in earlier years. We've already previewed Keith Richards' autobiography, Life, and I'm sure that those rocketing sales are giving Keith a lot of, wait for it, satisfaction. Today, we'll look at books on the lives of mega music personalities, from John Lennon to Bob Dylan to Frank Sinatra. So stay tuned.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Growing up in Greenwich Village as a young teenager in the mid-60s, Sean Willance discovered the music of Bob Dylan. Almost half a century later, he revisits Dylan's work with the skills of an eminent American historian, as well as the passion of a fan. Drawn in part from Willance's essays as historian in residence of Dylan's official website, Bob Dylan in America is a unique blend of fact, interpretation, and affinity. Beginning with Dylan's explosion onto the music scene in 1961, this book follows the star as he continues to develop a body of musical and literary work unique in our cultural history. Willance's approach places Dylan's music in the context of its time, including the early influences of popular front ideology and beat aesthetics, and offers a larger critical appreciation of Dylan as both a songwriter and a performer. Willance has had unprecedented access to studio tapes, recording notes, rare photographs, and other materials, all of which allow him to tell Dylan's story, and in fact, he narrates the book as well. Philip Roth commented, "All the American connections that Willance draws to explain the appearance of Dylan's music are fascinating, particularly at the outset, the connection to Aaron Copland. The writing is strong, the thinking is strong, the book is dense and strong everywhere you look."
The Gaslight proclaimed itself, carnival style, as world famous for the best entertainment in the village. Unlike many of the other clubs, it was not a so-called basket house, where walk-on performers of widely ranging competence earned only what they managed to collect in a basket they passed around the audience. The Gaslight was an elite spot, where talent certified by Dave Van Ronk and other insiders, as many as 6 performers a night, received regular pay. Not that the place was fancy in any way. Pine paneled until its owners stripped it down to its brick walls, and faintly illuminated by fake Tiffany, or as Van Ronk called them, Tiffanoid, lamps, the Gaslight had leaky pipes that dripped on what passed for a stage, no liquor license, that's what brown paper bags and the kettle of fish were for, a tolerable sound system, and hardly any room. If one used a crowbar and a mallet, it might have been possible to jimmy 100 people in there. The threat of a police raid for noisiness or overcrowding or refusing to play along and pay off the mob was constant. But on McDougal Street, playing the Gaslight was like playing Carnegie Hall. Van Ronk was the king of the hill among the Gaslight's folk singers. The MC was Noel Stuckey, who became the Paul of Peter, Paul, and Mary. And the headliners included Tom Paxton, Len Chandler, Hugh Romney, better known as the late 1960s psychedelic prankster and communalist Wavy Gravy, and young comics like Bill Cosby and Woody Allen. When Dylan, with Van Ronk's imprimatur, cracked the Gaslight's prestigious performer's circle in 1961, he secured $60 a week, which gave him enough to afford the rent on a 4th Street apartment, and took a big step toward real fame and fortune. "It was a club I wanted to play, needed to," Dylan recalls in his memoir, Chronicles Volume 1. A remarkable tape survives of what appears to have been a splicing together of two of Dylan's Gaslight performances, recorded in October 1962, in accord with what then qualified as professional recording standards. Widely circulated for many years as a bootleg, the tape was eventually released in abbreviated form in 2005 as a limited edition compact disc, Live at the Gaslight 1962. The singer may have left his harmonica rack at home. In any case, this is one of the few early recordings where he performs for an audience without his harmonicas. But for all of its unpretentious, even impromptu qualities, the tape reveals how greatly and rapidly Dylan's creativity was growing. A year earlier, Van Ronk's first wife, Terry Thall, had recorded Dylan, also at the Gaslight but with far inferior equipment, in an attempt to persuade club owners in nearby cities to hire the young singer. Someone stole the tape from Thall. It has long been available as a vinyl LP and on compact disc, known to collectors as the first Gaslight tape. As a business scheme, the recording flopped, even though it included the best of Dylan's first songs, Song to Woody. A year later, though, Dylan had jumped to the level of composing A Hard Rain's a Gonna Fall, a song The World Beyond the Village and the folk revival would not hear until its release more than 6 months later on Dylan's second album, The Freewheelin' Bob Dylan.
I met one man who was wounded in love. I met another man who was wounded in hatred. And it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, and it's a hard rain gonna fall.
It might be the ghostly singing along by the audience on Hard Rain, or it could just be the benefits of hindsight, but this second Gaslight tape vibrates with a sensation that Bob Dylan was turning into something very different from what anyone had ever heard, an artist whose imagination stretched far beyond those of even the most accomplished folk songwriters of the day. I first heard Dylan perform 2 years after that, at Philharmonic Hall, not the Gaslight. It was another bit of luck. My father got hold of a pair of free tickets. And even though I was only 13, I'd been made acutely aware of Dylan's work. A slightly older friend had presented Freewheelin' to a little knot of kids in my liberal Unitarian church group as if it were a piece of just revealed scripture. I didn't understand half the album. Mostly I was fixed on its sleeve cover, with its now famous photograph of Dylan, shoulders hunched against the cold, arm in arm with a gorgeous girl walking on Jones Street. A picture that, with its hip sexiness, was more arousing than anything I'd glimpsed in furtive schoolboy copies of Playboy.
Patti Smith and Robert Mapplethorpe weren't always famous, but they always thought they would be. In 1967, 21-year-old Smith became determined to make art her life. Working factory jobs and going nowhere in Philadelphia, she left for a new life in New York. Soon she found herself homeless, jobless, and hungry. While on the street, she met a young man named Robert Mapplethorpe who changed her life. They were both adrift but determined and made a pact to keep each other afloat until they found their voices. Lovers first and then friends, as Mapplethorpe discovered he was gay, they divided their dimes between art supplies and Coney Island hot dogs. Mapplethorpe was quicker to find his métier, with a Polaroid and then a Hasselblad, but Smith was first to find fame, transformed to her friend's delight from a poet into a rock star. Her album, Horses, has been hailed as one of the top 100 albums of all time. She has 11 other albums to her credit. Smith has been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That was in 2007. Just Friends is Smith's beautifully crafted love letter to her friend Robert Mapplethorpe, who died in 1989. In it, she takes readers on a journey to the heady days for art and artists in New York. She shares stories from Max's Kansas City, the Hotel Chelsea, Scribner's, Brentano's, and the Strand bookstores. In the lobby of the Chelsea Hotel, where she and Mapplethorpe lived for many years, she got to know William Burroughs, Allen Ginsberg, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, and Johnny Winter. Now, readers, a word of caution. For some reason, on Audible.com, the audio title they feature is in Swedish. So you're going to have to pick up this book. And you'll be glad you did, because it features some wonderful photographs. I thought you might enjoy hearing a short sample of her wonderful writing. I'll point out here that the Bobby she refers to is not Bobby McGee, but Bobby Neuwirth, a major figure on the scene at that time. So here goes a snippet from the book that I'm reading for you. When Janis Joplin returned in August for her rain date in Central Park, she seemed extremely happy. She was looking forward to recording and came into town resplendent in magenta, pink, and purple feather boas. She wore them everywhere. The concert was a great success, and afterward we all went to Remington, an artist bar near Broadway. The tables were crowded with her entourage: Michael Pollard, Sally Grossman, who was the girl in the red dress on the cover of Bringing It All Back Home, Bryce Marden, and the actress Tuesday Weld. The jukebox was playing Charlie Pride. Janis spent most of the party with a good-looking guy she was attracted to, but just before closing time, he ducked out with one of the prettier hangers-on. Janis was devastated. "This always happened to me, man, just another night alone," she sobbed on Bobby's shoulder. Bobby asked me to get her back to the Chelsea and to keep an eye on her. I took Janis back to her room and sat with her while she bemoaned her fate. Before I left, I told her that I'd made a little song for her, and I sang it to her. I was working real hard to show the world what I could do. Oh, I guess I never dreamed I'd have to. World spins some photographs how I love to laugh when the crowd laughs, while love slips through a theater that is full. But oh, baby, when the crowd goes home and I turn in and realize I'm alone, I can't believe I had to sacrifice you. She said, "That's me, man, that's my song." As I was leaving, she looked in the mirror, adjusting her boas. "How do I look, man?" "Like a pearl," I answered, "a pearl of a girl."
Social media, it's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
The son of a Vanderbilt heiress, John Hammond listened to jazz records with his parents' servants, went to Harlem as a teenager, and became a regular in clubs where very few white faces ever appeared. In the book, Producer, John Hammond and the Soul of American Music, author Dunstan Pryle tells a tale many music lovers may not have known. Taking a little family money, John Hammond went across racial lines in pre-World War II America and came back with recordings of some of the greatest jazz musicians in history. By age 22, he had convinced Benny Goodman to integrate his band and made his first big discovery, Billie Holiday. Later, as jazz gave way to pop and rock, Hammond championed Bob Dylan, Aretha Franklin, Bruce Springsteen, and Stevie Ray Vaughan. In Pryle's hands, Hammond's biography is the story of American popular music since the 1930s. It's a tale of a man at the center of things with his ears wide open. The book is narrated by Ray Porter.
Deep within the bowels of the Dunkin' Donuts Center in Providence, Rhode Island, on a bitterly cold night, he recalled the morning in May 1972 when he first auditioned for Hammond in Hammond's office at Columbia Records in Midtown Manhattan. Although he was just 22 years old at the time and virtually unknown outside the insular music scene along the Jersey Shore. Springsteen said Hammond treated him with respect and took his music seriously from the very start. Indeed, Hammond, the same man who had discovered Bob Dylan, Aretha Franklin, and Billie Holiday, had treated him as an artist. Quite a bit of water had passed under the bridge in the ensuing 30 years, but Springsteen's recollections of Hammond were vivid and personal. He clearly enjoyed digging back into his memory to a time when he had to hustle just to get a gig in a small Greenwich Village club. In less than an hour, he and the members of his E Street band were due on stage to perform in front of another sold-out arena. His legs were thin, and his face was sort of craggy and lined. But now in his mid-50s, he was still wiry and athletic. And intense. Relaxed and friendly, but always intense. Sitting forward with his elbows on his knees, his hands clasped tightly in front of him, Springsteen threw himself into his memories of his old friend and mentor. It was rather touching. Laughing, he did imitations. Nearly everyone who ever met John Hammond has his or her own version. "That's marvelous, marvelous, Bruce," he mimicked in Hammond's signature Brahmin accent. He also described a kindly protective figure in a business known for predators. "I always felt that my music was safe with him," Springsteen recalled. "It was just a wonderful way to be introduced to the music business. If there's anything like it today, and I don't think there is anymore, I would wish it on anyone who was just getting started like I was." Springsteen was touring in support of his latest album, The Rising, whose songs were written in the aftermath of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks, and whose themes reflected an angry, confused, but still hopeful nation. The album served as a sort of rock and roll salve for a nation in shock. Few popular artists could have attempted such a sensitive mission, that of embracing unspeakable and unprecedented tragedy within the context of celebratory rock and roll, without coming off as either exploitative or simply maudlin. Springsteen pulled it off with aplomb. Despite its potentially limited commercial appeal given its often raw subject matter, The Rising was clearly an album Springsteen felt he had to make. In other words, it was exactly the kind of album John Hammond would have appreciated. Certainly that passion for writing and performing songs that express universal experiences through a personal and singular point of view was one of the characteristics that Hammond found compelling in Springsteen more than 30 years ago. The roster of artists with whom Hammond is most closely associated is staggering, not only for the success of the figures on it, but for the diversity of their talents. All of them might fairly be recognized as geniuses in some form or another, but their talents were expressed in markedly different ways. For instance, Charlie Christian was a prodigy, almost savant-like in his ability to play a guitar unlike anyone who had ever played it before. Hammond recognized that and made certain millions of jazz fans got the opportunity to hear Christian play. Yet the genius that has inspired Bob Dylan, and Bruce Springsteen for that matter, is far more subtle and subjective. Not nearly as obvious as a guitar player with brilliant chops. But when Hammond saw it, raw and unpolished as it was with Dylan in September 1961, and again with Springsteen more than a decade later, he recognized it immediately and promptly set about ensuring that others heard it. Many of the figures on that list have emerged as icons of the past century, their renown reaching far beyond the popular music realm in which they first became famous. For Americans of the World War II generation, the music of Benny Goodman and Count Basie was as ubiquitous as advertisements for war bonds, and the swing jazz they played was seen as a symbol of America's blustery freedoms.
In Frank the Voice, a riveting and fast-paced biography, James Kaplan chronicles Sinatra's somewhat unlikely meteoric ascent to success, his failures, and his rebirth as a star of song and screen. With exhaustive detail, Kaplan engagingly recreates Sinatra's childhood in Hoboken, New Jersey. By the time he was 12, Sinatra was singing for quarters on top of the piano bar in his father's tavern. At 21, Frankie joined a group that became known as the Hoboken Four. Kaplan journeys through Sinatra's early years with Tommy Dorsey and his long solo career. He looks at his first marriage to Nancy Barbato and his more famous marriage to Ava Gardner, and then through the star's movie career and his rebirth in the early 1950s. Although Sinatra's career often faltered in the late 1940s, his partnership with Nelson Riddle and the release of the song Young at Heart in 1953 began Sinatra's comeback. Kaplan's enthralling tale of this American icon and pop culture in the middle of the century is a real page-turner. It's narrated by Rob Shapiro.
Frank Sinatra bore the scars of his birth, both physical and psychological, to the end of his years. A bear-rug cherubic baby picture shot a few weeks after he was born was purposely taken from his right side, since the wounds on the left side of his face and neck were still angry-looking. Throughout Sinatra's vastly documented life, he would rarely, especially if he had anything to do with it, be photographed from his left. One scar, hard to disguise, though frequently airbrushed, ran diagonally from the lower left corner of his mouth to his jawline. His ear on that side had a bifurcated lobe, the classic cauliflower. But that was the least of it. The delicate ridges and planes of his left outer ear were mashed, giving the appearance, in early pictures, of an apricot run over by a steamroller. The only connection between the sonic world and the external auditory meatus, the ear hole, was a vertical slit. Later, plastic surgery would correct the problem to some extent. That wasn't all. In childhood, a mastoid operation would leave a thick ridge of scar tissue on his neck behind the ear's base. A severe case of cystic acne in adolescence compounded his sense of disfigurement. As an adult, he would apply Max Factor pancake makeup to his face and neck every morning, and again after each of the several showers he took daily. Sinatra later told his daughter Nancy that when he was 11, after some playmates began to call him Scarface, he went to the house of the physician who had delivered him, determined to give the good doctor a good beating. Fortunately, the doctor wasn't home. Even when he was in his early 40s, on top of the world and in the midst of an artistic outpouring unparalleled in the history of popular music, the birth trauma and his mother were very much on Sinatra's mind. Once, in a moment of extraordinary emotional nakedness, the singer opened up very briefly to a lover. "They weren't thinking about me," he said bitterly. "They were just thinking about my mother. They just kind of ripped me out and tossed me aside." He was talking to Peggy Connolly, a young singer whom he met in 1955 and who, for almost 3 years at the apex of his career, would be as close to him as it was possible for anyone to be. The scene was Madrid in the spring of 1956. Sinatra was in Spain shooting a movie he had little taste for. One night in a small nightclub, as he and the 24-year-old Connolly sat in the dark at the edge of the dance floor, she caressed his left cheek. But when her fingertips touched his ear, he flinched. She asked him what was wrong, and he admitted he was sensitive about his deformity. "I really don't think I had ever noticed it truly," Connolly said many years later. This was early on in our relationship. Sinatra then went on to spill out the whole story of his birth, his great weight, 13.5 pounds, the ripping forceps, the way he'd essentially been left for dead. "There was no outburst of emotion," Connolly recalled. "There was instead an obvious, lingering bitterness about what he felt had been a stupid neglect of his infant self to concentrate only on his mother, intimating that he was sort of ripped from her entrails and tossed aside. Otherwise, his torn ear might have been tended to." In the years immediately following the harrowing birth of her only child, Dolly Sinatra seems to have compensated in her own way. She became a midwife and sometime abortionist. For the latter activity, she got a nickname, Hatpin Dolly, and a criminal record. And while she sometimes refused to accept payment for terminating pregnancies, she could afford the generosity. Her legitimate business of midwifery, at $50 per procedure, a substantial sum at the time, helped support her family in handsome fashion. Strikingly, two of her arrests, one in late 1937 and one in February 1939, just 3 weeks after her son's wedding, neatly bracketed Frank Sinatra's own two arrests in November and December 1938 for the then criminal offenses of, in the first case, seduction, and in the second, adultery. Also remarkable is that all these Sinatra arrests were sex-related, and that none of them would have occurred today. What was happening in this family? To begin to answer the question, we have to cast ourselves back into the knockabout Italian streets of Hoboken in the 1920s and 1930s, and into the thoroughly unpsychological household of Dolly and Marty Sinatra.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
The title from the country world, because some of us are fans. For 30 years as a musician, Roseanne Cash has enjoyed both critical and commercial success, releasing albums notable for their lyrical intelligence and their musicality. Now in her memoir, Composed, Cash writes compellingly about her upbringing in Southern California, about being the child of country legend Johnny Cash, and her relationship with her mother and her famous stepmother, June Carter Cash. In her development as an artist, she shares memories of a hilarious stint as a 20-year-old working for Columbia Records in London, recording her own first album on a German label, working her way to success, her marriage to Rodney Crowell, a union that made them Nashville's premier couple, and her decision to take a new direction in her music and leave Nashville to move to New York. She also discusses her personal life and the fulfillment she's found with her current husband and musical collaborator, John Leventhal. Let's listen as Roseanne herself narrates her story.
I have abandoned my reliance on the external facts to support an individual truth, and everyone is entitled to his or her own. This is mine. So far, so good. More to come. More is always to come. I was born in Memphis, Tennessee on May 24, 1955. A month before my dad's first single, Cry, 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 was released on Sun Records. My mother had only two dresses that fit her in late pregnancy, she told me, and in her final month, during the most summer-like of the sultry late spring days in East Memphis, she would sit on the steps of the front porch and eat an entire wash basin of cherry tomatoes. It was her one craving. On the afternoon of May 24th, my mother went to her regular appointment with her obstetrician, who examined her and told her to go straight to the hospital. This baby is going to be born today, he said. I was born after only 4 hours of labor at 8 o'clock that evening. My mother later told me that the loneliest she had ever felt was when she was wheeled through the double doors of the hospital maternity ward to give birth and looked back to see my dad standing forlornly in the waiting room. He paced and smoked there for the next 4 hours while she labored alone and chewed on a wet washcloth when the pains overtook her. She always spoke with great resentment about the fact that she was given a damp washcloth to suck and then left alone in a hospital room. She was awake for the entire 4 hours of labor and given nothing for pain, and then put to sleep for the actual birth. It all sounded like a mean-spirited, medieval exercise in physical endurance and emotional isolation. Her accounts of it were so cinematic and full of emotion that I grew up terrified of the prospect of childbirth. I had very few fantasies about having children or being a mother because I could not get past the specter of childbirth, which seemed almost a horrible end in itself, with something only vague and indefinable on the other side of it. The fact that I eventually did bear 4 children, delivered both naturally and with pain medication, never really lessened my fear. When my mother went back for her 6-week checkup after my birth, the doctor informed her that she was pregnant again. My sister Kathy was born 10 months and 23 days after me. Kathy was a fragile child who had mysterious illnesses and the worst versions of every childhood disease, and I've always felt guilty that I may have taken all the nutrients out of my mother's body when I inhabited her womb just before Kathy's arrival there. 2 years after Kathy's birth, my sister Cindy was born, and soon after that, we moved from Memphis to Southern California. My sister Tara was born shortly after we settled in Encino, in the San Fernando Valley. My mother's 4th pregnancy and delivery were difficult for her. She carried Tara for 10 months and endured a hard 16-hour labor. After the birth of her 4th daughter, my mother, in tears, informed my father that she was finished with childbearing, even though she had initially said she wanted 6 children. My father agreed, although he harbored a secret desire for a son, which he finally got when I was 15, and he was married to June, not my mother. My parents bought Johnny Carson's house on Havenhurst Avenue in Encino. My most vivid memory of the 3 years we lived there was of the day a film crew showed up in our living room to tape a show called Here's Hollywood. My mother was extremely nervous, and we children were made to dress up in poofy dresses, white ankle socks, and black patent leather shoes with our hair pulled tightly back into bows. We had to sit absolutely still and silent on the sofa next to my parents while the camera was trained on us and the interviewer spoke to them. Then we were sent outside while Mom and Dad were interviewed alone. The whole experience was profoundly unsettling to me. It may have been the first time that I registered, at age 5, how it felt to be truly angry. I didn't like how my mother changed for the camera, showing only a social veneer that didn't represent her true self at all. And I didn't like it that my dad had even allowed them in our house.
From his dazzling conducting debut in 1943 until his death in 1990, Leonard Bernstein's star blazed brilliantly. I had the privilege of meeting and speaking with the maestro when he was conducting in Israel in the late 1970s. I was just a college kid, but he was extremely approachable and wonderfully engaging. In this fresh and revealing biography of Bernstein's political life, Leonard Bernstein, The Political Life of an American Musician, Barry Seldes examines Bernstein's career against the backdrop of Cold War America, his blacklisting by the State Department in 1950, voluntary exile from the New York Philharmonic in 1951 for fear he might be blacklisted, signing a humiliating affidavit to regain his passport, and the factors that by the mid-1950s allowed his triumphant return to the New York Philharmonic. Seldes for the first time links Bernstein's great concert hall and musical theater achievements and his real and perceived artistic setbacks to his involvement with progressive political causes. Making extensive use of previously untapped FBI files, as well as overlooked materials in the Library of Congress's Bernstein's archive, Seldes illuminates the ways in which Bernstein's career intersected with the 20th century's most momentous events. This broadly accessible and impressively documented account of the celebrity maestro's life deepens our understanding of an entire era, revealing important and often ignored intersections of American culture and political power. Dick Hill narrates this fascinating story.
Yet this seemingly unambiguously celebratory day had interesting ironies known only by Bernstein and a few others. For example, as the maestro gave the downbeat to the Philharmonic's brass section to begin Copland's fanfare, only a tiny minority of the onlookers were likely aware, as Bernstein certainly was, that only 6 years before, in 1953, Eisenhower had banned a performance of Copland's Lincoln portrait at his inauguration because Copland was a supporter of left-wing causes. Did the crowd know that President Truman, in February 1950, had banned Bernstein's music from overseas State Department libraries and functions? Or that in 1953, Eisenhower's State Department had revoked Bernstein's passport on the grounds that the maestro was a security risk, returning it only after Bernstein, his conducting career on the verge of wreckage, agreed to sign an affidavit confessing to political sins? These darker events were certainly in Bernstein's mind, and perhaps Eisenhower's, as the two Olympians shook hands in joint celebration. Such were the paradoxes and ironies of that day. The fanfare, waving flags, and hearty handshakes masking a closely guarded tale of presidentially authorized censorship, intimidation, and humiliation. This tale, and other aspects of Bernstein's political life, his blacklisting by CBS in 1950, his later removal from the blacklist, and his return to the podium of the New York Philharmonic as principal conductor and then music director, is the one I tell in these pages. The narrative shows how closely intertwined were Bernstein's political life, philosophic outlook, and music as they developed within the larger contours and contradictions of American political life from the 1930s to his death in 1990. No one has written this narrative until now. In fact, those who have written about Bernstein have tended to avoid thematic discussion of his political life. This gap is unfortunate because Bernstein was highly political. He was inevitably responsive to developments in the political and moral climate. His choice of texts to set to music often revealed his political concerns. To ignore the impact of political forces upon Bernstein is to miss out on much of what enlivened and motivated him. This book, which draws on materials in the Leonard Bernstein collection at the Library of Congress and hundreds of pages in the FBI's Bernstein dossier, much for the first time, offers a new and, I hope, fuller understanding of Bernstein's life, art, and times. That the perspective herein differs markedly from those of other biographies will be evident immediately. Whereas I see Bernstein's political, philosophical, and musical lives as all of a piece, Bernstein's first biographer, Joan Pizer, writing in 1987, offers some summary passages about Bernstein's political activity in the 1940s and attributes his activism to prolonged immaturity, which he grew out of and which bore no relationship to his musical career. Humphrey Burton, who directed many of the films of Bernstein's concerts for Deutsche Grammophon and apparently knew him well, sees Bernstein's political life as a collection of occasional and momentary events that had no connection to his work as composer and conductor. Meryl Sechrest devotes 2 pages of her book to Bernstein's left-wing political life in the 1940s, but like her predecessors, Pizer and Burton, she does not examine the deeper effects of his politics on his mindset. Record producer Paul Myers, to whom I will return shortly, concludes that Bernstein was largely apolitical. This general failure to deal comprehensively with Bernstein's lifelong political thought is readily explainable. Pizer wrote her book with Bernstein's cooperation, but apparently did not gain access to the Bernstein papers and was explicitly denied access to the FBI files that the Bernstein office obtained under the Freedom of Information Act. Without such permission, Pizer was unable to obtain access to the FBI files while Bernstein was alive.
Robert Hilburn, one of rock music's most respected critics, is a very lucky guy. Not only was he music editor at the Los Angeles Times for 3.5 decades, when most of the best rock and roll was being creative, but he's been privy to iconic occasions in music history that no other journalist has witnessed. His memoir, Cornflakes with John Lennon and Other Tales from a Rock and Roll Life, is a catalog of legendary figures and moments that will amaze and delight anyone with even a mild interest in popular culture. The memoir is organized chronologically, beginning with Elvis and Lennon. He met John Lennon during his last weekend period in Los Angeles, and they became friends. Bob Dylan granted him his only interviews during his born-again period and on the occasion of his 50th birthday. Michael Jackson invited Hilburn to watch cartoons with him in his bedroom. When Springsteen took to playing only old hits, Hilburn scolded him for turning his legendary concerts into oldies reviews, and Springsteen changed his set list. Bono weighs in with an introduction about how Hilburn's criticism influenced and altered his own development as a musician. And Hilburn was the only reporter at Johnny Cash's famous Folsom Prison show. The book is narrated by Hilburn's son, Rob Hilburn Jr. The author, now in his early 70s, is passing the torch, and it burns brightly. Rob Jr. turns in a reverent and personal portrait of his father's voice, telling stories by radiating the same wit and enthusiasm with which they were no doubt told to him in his youth. Elton John says, "So many great memories came flooding back to me when I read Cornflakes with John Lennon. It's a must-read for genuine music lovers." And Yoko Ono shares, "Hilburn's amazing resilience and commitment for music shines through his decades of reportage and reviews of music. On behalf of the musicians of the 60s on, I thank you for having been the communicator of our music with love." I don't think endorsements can get any better than that, do you? Let's hear a bit of this wonderful book.
I've experienced hundreds of memorable concert and interview moments, so it's hard to rank them in any favorite order. But my final hours with John in New York are certainly on the short list. It was just weeks before his death in December of 1980, and his playing the summer record was an endearing greeting, and one that was typical of John. Of the hundreds of musicians I've met, John was among the most down-to-earth. I was in New York to spend 3 days with John and Yoko while they finished Double Fantasy, John's first record collection of new material since the mostly forgettable Walls and Bridges 6 years earlier. He returned to New York after the lost weekend period and spent the next 5 years rebuilding his life with Yoko and helping to raise their son, Sean. On this day, he looked nice and trim in jeans, a jean jacket, and a white T-shirt. He was maybe 25 pounds slimmer than the last time I'd seen him. "It's mother's macrobiotic diet," he said later, and employing his nickname for Yoko. "She makes sure I stay on it." By the time we headed to the recording studio, it was nearly dark. As a limo pulled up to the studio's dimly lit entrance, I could see the outlines of a couple dozen fans in the shadows. They raced toward the car as soon as the driver opened John's door. Flashbulbs went off with blinding speed. Without a bodyguard, John was helpless, and I later asked if he didn't worry about his safety. "They don't mean any harm," he replied. "Besides, what can you do? You can't spend all your life hiding from people. You've got to get out and live some, don't you?" Inside the studio, I heard several tracks from Double Fantasy, which was John's most revealing album since Imagine. Some critics branded the gentle, relaxed tone of the collection too soft. They missed the old Lennon bite. To me, however, the collection was a marvelous reflection of John's mood, and Grammy voters were right when they named it Album of the Year. I spent hours at the apartment in the studio talking to John about the changes since Los Angeles. He felt at peace for one of the few times in his life. He was deeply in love with Yoko and thrilled to be a father again. He also spoke with affection about the Beatles days and how much he still looked forward to seeing Paul. That surprised me because of the sarcastic barbs he'd launched in interviews and the biting lyrics he'd written about Paul since the breakup of the band. "Ah, don't believe all that," he said, smiling. "Paul's like a brother. We've gotten way past all that." He also spoke fondly of Ringo, but more distantly about George. He felt slighted by some things in George's autobiography, I Me Mine, especially George's failure to give John credit for helping him learn guitar techniques. Mostly we talked about the house husband period that was just ending, a time of emotional drying out, a chance to reset priorities. He may have declared, "I don't believe in the Beatles," in God, on his 1970 album Plastic Ono Band, but it took the 5-year sabbatical that followed the lost weekend for him to break away from the suffocating pressures of being an ex-Beatle, including the need to mirror in his music and in his life the image of the witty, sarcastic John. During his time away, he learned that there was personal joy and fulfillment away from the rock and roll merry-go-round. For Double Fantasy, he even wrote a tender song about his newfound outlook and freedom, Watching the Wheels. On that November night, the studio atmosphere was so relaxed that John invited me to contribute to the album's sound effects. Yoko and I took turns dropping coins into a tin bowl to duplicate the sound of someone giving change to a beggar. We had to do it several times before the noise level was just right. For most of the evening, I just watched John and Yoko at work and took advantage of breaks to ask them questions. The studio tape must have been running much of the time because years later, a bootleg of that interview surfaced in Japan. One thing troubled me during the all-night recording sessions, the way John would slip in from time to time to an adjoining lounge. The first thing that came to mind was drugs, because I was so used to seeing musicians pass around bowls of cocaine with the casualness of M&Ms. John had had drug problems earlier in his life, and I feared he had relapsed despite all his talk about feeling healthier than ever. Maybe the pressure of being back in the studio was greater than he was letting on. At one point, I happened into the lounge and saw John at the far end of the narrow room. He was reaching for something on a cabinet shelf, and my first instinct was to go back into the studio so I wouldn't violate his privacy. But he spotted me and called me over, putting his finger up to his lips in a signal to be quiet. When I was next to him, he reached into the cabinet again and pulled out something wrapped in a towel. "Want some?" he asked. "Just don't tell Mother," he said with a more conspiratorial look. "She doesn't want me doing this anymore." As he opened the towel, I had to laugh. John Lennon's private stash turned out to be a giant-sized Hershey bar. He broke off a chunk for me and one for himself. Holding his piece in a toast, John smiled and said, "Good to see you again."
Readers, I have a very special guest with me today, Aaron James, who has written my theme music, It's a Fine Line. Welcome, Aaron.
Hello.
It's great to have you here. Now, I know a little bit about you, and I know that you originally from Massachusetts. And tell us how you ended up in Texas and became a blues artist.
Let's see. I was a film and drama major in college. And
where'd you go to college?
At Vassar College.
Vassar. Okay.
And a bunch of my friends and classmates moved down to Austin to start up a children's television show. And I had a $60,000 a year job lined up, and then I could go and sleep on their couch instead and waitress. But I heard there was a good blues scene in Texas, so I decided to head down to Austin, Texas. And they all stayed 6 months, and I have been there since 1994.
Now, how did you get interested in blues?
Somebody gave me a B.B. King tape. I'd heard some Muddy Waters. I'd heard some various things that kept on moving me closer to the blues. But somebody that used to come and hear my a cappella group play at Vassar all the time handed me a B.B. King tape and said, "You should really be listening to this and singing this kind of stuff." So,
when did you take up playing the bass? Because I know that's your instrument in the band.
Well, when I first moved down to Austin and started sitting in and singing at blues jams, I kind of thought I didn't just want to be a singer, I wanted to be part of the band and do double duty per se. And seeing as I sang bass in my a cappella group, I decided that would be the perfect instrument. So when that was about 1997. When I started, I had my first bass gig in 1998.
How has the blues scene evolved from the time that you first got to Austin till now, today?
There was a wonderful blues scene downtown on 6th Street. Now it's all turned very Stevie Ray Vaughan guitar oriented, which is, I understand he's from Texas, but it was a much different sound before. It was a much deeper, richer blues sound. And now,
who were your original mentors?
Let's see. Uncle John Turner was a big one. He was the drummer for the original Johnny Winter Band. He played at Woodstock, and he was a lot of fun. He turned me on to a lot of Louisiana-style blues, New Orleans stuff.
All right, since this show is about authors and writers, can you tell us the process of how you write a song? Do you start first with the lyrics, or does a tune come into your head? How is that process?
It kind of happens all sorts of different ways. Sometimes I have notebooks and notebooks full of single verses and that came to me with the music, you know, maybe 5 years ago. And I think one line is good and I might use it someday. So I have notebooks and notebooks of those. And a lot of the time, those kind of things happen to me, say, in the shower or somewhere where I'm hearing a distant strain of maybe just the bass line or something that really gelled for me, have come to me all at once, just the music and the words. You know, it might take me a day or so to finish all the lyrics, but I can tell their songs right from the get-go.
And then how do you write the parts for the different instruments in the band?
I kind of let them write themselves, except I might have an idea, like on the latter of my two CDs, there's a song called Fear, and I knew exactly what I wanted the guitar to feel like, and I knew exactly what I wanted the whole song to feel like. So I said to the piano player, just make this as dark as you possibly can, and you know, at the end of the song, I want you to feel like you've just had somebody point their finger right in your face. And after I finished describing it to him, he said, okay, so you want people to feel like they have to take a shower after they're done listening to this? And I said, yep, that's exactly what I want.
Now, your first CD was called?
You Had to Go.
You Had to Go.
Mm-hmm.
And your second CD?
The second CD was after I had spent 7 years with one band and was launching off on my own in a different direction, because although I love the Texas blues guitar sound, I didn't want it to be all about the guitar. I wanted to have more of a band sound. And so I actually brought in a cast of like 14 people on that one, some of whom I play with regularly, some of whom I've never played with since.
Now, where can our listeners actually get these CDs?
You can get them, you can download them on iTunes, or you can find them at cdbaby.com.
Now, Fine Line is actually our theme song. Do you remember writing that? Tell us about, you know, were there any stories about writing or recording that song?
I wrote it in a hotel room in Milan.
Milan, Italy?
Yeah.
What were you doing there?
Playing.
Okay.
We were touring Italy. I can't really tell you where in Italy we ended up, because nobody that was taking us around spoke English. I was like, are those the Alps? Somebody, are those the Alps? But yeah, I was. I had a friendship, I guess, back in the States kind of fall to pieces, and it was really eating at me and chewing on me, and so it came out in a song.
Oh. And you're touring Europe again this summer, aren't you?
Yeah.
Where will you be this summer?
Germany, I know. I'm pretty sure Sweden, Denmark, and who knows where else we might end up.
Now, if the listeners get to Austin, where might they find you playing, and how do they find out your schedule?
I try to keep Reverb Nation .com updated as far as my schedule. So that's probably the best place. You can also find me on Facebook or erinjames.com.
Spell that name again.
J-A-I-M-E-S.
J-A-I-M-E-S. Okay. Now, what are we going to be listening to? And tell us about the evolution of that song.
I think we should listen to Soul Garden. If you've ever been to Austin, then you probably know about Barton Springs and about Zilker Park and the little miniature train that goes around the park. And so I was the engineer on that train for a couple of years. And when you're going around the park 11 times a day for 23 minutes every time, it gives you quite a bit of time to think. And I would hear something on the radio that I hadn't heard before while I was sitting in the depot selling tickets, and then go out on the train and just have something different form in my head. And I'm sure all the kids thought it was crazy seeing their engineer singing, because they could see me in the mirror and they could probably hear me too. But I was in a pretty heavy duty relationship, not in a positive way at that time, but I wrote a sarcastic song. Everything that I wished it was that it wasn't, and it, lo and behold, turned into a love song called Soul Garden. And years later, I got married, and the song came true, so...
Happily ever after.
Happily ever after.
Okay. Listeners, we're going to hear Soul Garden very soon, and I just wanted to reinforce, where can we find your music, Erin?
At cdbaby.com, at iTunes, and you can just find my website. You can either go to Facebook or go to erinjames.com. That's erinjames.com.
Erin James, which is very appropriate since it's almost St. Patty's Day, so which is very close to Erin's birthday. So erinjames.com. Thanks so much for being with us today, Erin.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Bye. Okay, that's all the musical memoirs we have time for today. Please write and let me know your particular genres of interest, and I'll do my best to cover them on an upcoming show. You can reach me at elaine@bookreportradio.com. You can also find previous editions of the show at bookreportradio.com. Speaking of music, let's exit to the tune of Soul Garden by our guest today, Austin, Texas blues artist Erin James. I'm Elaine Charles. See you right here next week for the next chapter of The Book Report. Smile on my face, baby. So welcome into my space. And to eliminate the question, I will make a small suggestion. Come on and walk with me, walk with me, walk with me, walk in my in my in my